Hello, intrepid leaders, and welcome to another episode of the Leadership Log, where we talk about navigating everyday leadership. Joining us today to chat about psychological safety is the lovely Tom Gaiety. I hope I've said that right, Tom. In this episode, quite frankly, I struggle to contain my excitement to be talking about a real passion of mine. Join Tom and I as we geek out together and explore the concept of psychological safety. Find out why he describes himself as an experimentalist, which started with weed science, and how he became interested in psychological safety. We explore the history and evolution of the concept and how it has been defined and how it can be operationalized. We talk about the importance of the ability and the internal belief to speak up, and Tom shares an incredibly personal experience. And unsurprisingly, Amy Edmondson gets a mention or two, as does Tom's wonderful weekly newsletter. It's safe to say, see what I did there, that I had a blast chatting to a fellow psychological safety advocate and enthusiast. Tom's insights are thought-provoking and his honesty is inspiring. It was an absolute joy. I hope you enjoy the episode too. So let's jump in. Welcome to the Leadership Blog, Tom, and thank you for taking the time to be with us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good, thank you, Becky, and it's super fantastic to be here. I'm really pleased to be invited. Thank you so much.
I feel like I'm fangirling, and I'm not sure that I should say this, but like, I you know, Amy Edmondson is up there, but I have to say you are quite a close second for me. So I'm so grateful for you giving your time and recording with me. I'm super excited to have a conversation with you around all things psychological safety because, well, like you, I think we could talk about it till the cows come home. So that's really great.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. It's triggering my imposter syndrome, but yeah, thank you.
Oh, well, I didn't mean to do that. We all get that from time to time. By the end of it, neither of us will have imposter syndrome, hopefully. Yeah. I mean, I usually start out with imposter syndrome, actually. It's interesting you should say that, because I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be talking to Tom, and he knows so much about psychological safety, et cetera, et cetera. So there we are. We're in good company now. That makes both of us hopefully feel a bit more relaxed.
Yeah, two imposters together.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess just to kickstart the conversation, I've heard you describe yourself as an experimentalist, and what do you mean by that? I mean, I love that term. I think it's fantastic. I like to think of myself as a disruptor. So, what do you mean by experimentalist?
Well, so this actually comes from my first job after uni.
What?
My degree, my first degree was in a number of things, and it was a sort of science degree, biological sciences degree, focused on plant science and crops and environmental management and ecology, and sort of covered a very broad spectrum. And the first job that I got after uni was for a big sort of research firm, and I was an experimentalist. I studied weeds, so I studied biochemical interactions in weeds and did experiments on weeds, and thus I was called an experimentalist. And I little did I know that the first job title I ever had would be the single coolest one that I'd have throughout my career.
That is a really cool title. But you know what? I think it's even more cool that you were doing experiments on weeds. We just put the S on the end there, Tom, to make sure there's no misinterpretation.
Well, the department was called Weed Science.
Weed Science. Yeah. I love that. It's like, well, it's just like one letter removed from the movie Weird Science, I guess, isn't
exactly.
it? Yes. Yeah. I wondered if you would. Yeah, that's amazing. I'm glad I asked you that question now. That's really interesting. So how did you get from, there we go then, how did you get from experimenting with weeds or weed science into psychological safety?
Yeah, So there's a number of roundabout ways, I guess, but the shorter story, the more concise story is that, so I sort of ended up getting into tech. So after doing that for a little while and driving tractors and doing all sorts of other interesting things, I ended up in technology, and I'd always been a bit of a techie and sort of, it was a natural flow for me. Ended up going through a number of sort of climbing the ladder, for want of a better word, and ended up in leadership and management roles. But in in a job about maybe 13, 14, whatever years ago, I had a boss who was the proper stereotypical screamy, shouty,
oh, yes,
blamey, like ranty boss.
Yeah.
And you can imagine the environment. It was a big open plan office with everyone sitting at cubicles, like really bored and you know, grey cubicles. And the boss had this fancy grey, fancy glass office in the corner.
As you do,
as these sort of bosses kind of have to have, yeah, with a big leather chair or whatever. And every now and then he would come out and just rip someone apart for some minor mistake or trying something that failed or doing something wrong or whatever it was. And he ruled by fear. That was how he got people to do he wanted them to do, but through fear. And I wasn't there long, but I realized quite quickly the effect that this had on the organization, well, on the team and on the organization, was that it became, what's the word, calcified, like slow and rigid, and no one wanted to try anything or do anything or suggest anything, because the risk, the consequence of trying things or saying or asking for things or trying and failing or making a mistake was so much greater than doing nothing. Doing nothing, safe option.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, and so everything slowed down, everything, the company got really, the company got out-competed by competitors, and it was a horrible workplace to be in. So I quite quickly sort of realized, well, sort of my internal logic was like, well, if that's the bad way of doing, I can see that's the bad way of doing things. The good way of doing things must be the opposite of that.
Yeah.
That's how my logic worked.
Yeah.
And possibly flawed, but it worked. And so for the years after that, I tried to create an environment of what I now call, what I have now learned is psychological safety. But at the time, I didn't know it was that. I just did it. But and then it was only, sort of maybe 5 or 6 years ago that I learned the term psychological safety. And that was the light bulb moment. That was the moment. This is the thing I'm trying to do. This is the umbrella term for all of this great stuff. And that opened all the doors, because suddenly when you've got a name for something, you can start to research it and define it and create a sort of collection of practices and all this other stuff that goes with it. And that was when it sort of really started to accelerate. Everything else.
Tom, so much of that resonates for me, I have to say. You know, there was so many, you know, when I first got into psychological safety, again, like you, I came across the term and had that eureka moment around, that's it. That's what I've been trying to say. I'm observing, I'm feeling, I'm observing others experiencing it. That's the thing. And so, yeah, so much of what you've just talked about resonates for me. I love the term you used there as well about how the organisation that you worked in, because of that fear, the team or the organisation became calcified. It's almost like stuck in its own way. And you know, psychological safety, you know, is the cornerstone of like creativity, creative thinking, innovation and all that, which is super important for improvement. But also in a leadership world, you know, if you want to grow and develop as a leader, you need people to be able to kind of give you that feedback and say, you know, you're being a really crappy boss, or maybe not in those words, but you know what I mean. So, yeah, so much of that resonates with me, and we could probably spend a lot of the podcast talking about that. But the other thing, I think you're not the only person to have had that, like, screamy veins in the forehead kind of boss. And there's something quite profound in there for me around that role modelling, and actually you took from him what not to do. So I think that, again, you know, that's a great reflection on how you ended up moving into this kind of like being a fierce advocate for, you know, creating psychologically safe climates in the workplace. And the other thing I liked you talked about as well is about this umbrella term, because that's absolutely it, isn't it? And for people who maybe don't understand what psychological safety is, they think it's one thing, but it isn't.
Yeah.
And with that said, one of the biggest things I learned from you, I think, was there was, because I knew Amy Edmondson had coined the term. I had no idea where maybe some of the other history came from. And I know this is a big challenge potentially, because I know there's a great history behind this, isn't it? Which stems further back than Amy even. So I just wondered if you wanted to just give a little brief overview of the what you know to be the kind of history of psychological safety.
Yeah, and like you say, this could be
a podcast. 2 hours itself,
but I think it's a great point because it's not I think it's important for us to remember that it's not a new concept. This has been around for a while, and even if it hasn't had a name, it goes back a long way. And so if we go back to the first time it was written down, or the first time we know it was written down, and or at least in the academic text, which was in, I think, 1965, I could be wrong, in a book by Edgar Schein and Warren Bennis called Personal and Organizational Change Through Group Methods, which is just a...
I was going to say, check in your bookcase. Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, well, mentioned in that. And so they were studying organizational change. And in fact, that's a first edition copy that I managed to find in a bookstore in Texas. So I was quite pleased to find that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was the first time it was mentioned. But it was just mentioned as a kind of just a thing, almost like a passing phrase.
Yeah.
They didn't dive into it really. And so it kind of went quiet for a little while. But then later, it wouldn't get into the 80s and 90s, things started to happen. William Edward Deming, in his Points for Management, 14 points, he describes, I think it's point eight, he describes drive out fear so that everyone may work effectively for the company.
Mm.
And one of the things one of the things I love about Deming is that he had a true systemic understanding. In fact, part of the system of profound knowledge is systems thinking. And he espoused this ability and willingness and desire to think in bigger systems and think about the system itself as a socio-technical system, not just processes and technology. And he fundamentally understood that people needed to operate in a psychologically safe, although he didn't use a term, but that was what he was describing. And it's fascinating. And then you've got things like the Toyota production system and the Andon cord. And one of the things I find most fascinating about the Andon, and we could talk about the Andon cord rates as well, but the Andon cord being the sort of stop the line, there's something wrong, we need, or not even something wrong, but there's an improvement to make, we need to make it. One of the things I find most fascinating about it is that the first thing that happens when someone pulls the cord is that they get praised for doing so.
Yeah.
Because we have to reduce the consequences. We have to sort of rally against the negative interpersonal consequences of speaking up or pulling the cord.
Yeah.
And Toyota, when Taichi Ono knew this, he, systems thinking chap, he understood that you can't just say, speak up, do a thing. It won't happen unless we reduce the fear, unless we take out the fear, drive out the fear.
Mm.
There was a guy called William Kahn who was sort of studying psychological safety. In fact, he was studying summer camp counselors in the 90s, and he started to talk about psychological safety. And then, of course, we come to Amy Edmondson in 1999.
Yes.
Clinical teams at Harvard and the mistakes that they make, and finding that the high-performing teams made more mistakes, and like, what's going on there?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where we have that's where the canonical somewhat canonical definition of psychological safety comes from.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And of course, then there was Project Aristotle, wasn't there? That then kind of really kind of went back to Amy's research in 1999 and kind of brought it back to life, I suppose, in some respect.
Brought it into the limelight, exactly.
Yes, yeah.
Shine a torch on it. And this is a fantastic point you make, because up until that point, at least the term psychological safety had purely been academic.
Yeah.
And it was Project Aristotle that brought it into the realm of industry and work and practitioners.
Yeah.
And that there's already, you know, Toyota and other people have been doing it, and I'm sure many other good managers throughout time have been doing it, but Aristotle put it out there and brought it into the real world.
Yeah, that's it. And I love the you know, I love the name of that project. You know, this, you know, this, what is it? The sum is greater than its parts, isn't it? That's why they called it Aristotle.
The whole is greater than
the whole is greater than. Yeah, yeah, I knew, yeah. I'd get it wrong. I always get it. But I got the gist of it. But well, first of all, congratulations, because that's brilliant that you managed to keep it as concise as you did. But that's fantastic, and I'm sure our listeners will really get something. There's a lot of signposting in there for them, I think, if they want to go off and find out more around psychological safety. And I'll make sure that a lot of that is in the show notes, including, obviously, you know, we mustn't forget your wonderful psychologically, you know, your psychologicalsafety.co.uk website, and also your newsletter. I'm going to keep going on about your newsletter, because it is just such a delightful email to receive on a Friday morning. But we'll talk a bit more about that in a second.
I'm really like it. I'm very pleased.
Yes. So we're talking about safety broadly, yeah, aren't we? We're talking about psychological safety. And in healthcare, as you know, I work in healthcare, we're very good at talking about safety, but very often we're talking about physical safety, I think. And so, you know, the dictionary describes safety as a state in which, or a place where, you are safe and not in danger or at risk. So that's a physical, it's physical, and it's about physical health and about kind of that more kind of visible safety, I suppose. So that's more visible to people, isn't it? So it almost feels more tangible, easier to do something about. Well, I say easier to do something about, you know, patient safety, falls, pressure ulcers remain some of our biggest challenges. So anyway, you know, the podcast isn't about that. But then this psychological health, which is this feeling, which is a little bit more, less tangible then, I suppose, isn't it? Because it's that feeling and that belief and that sense of being safe to take interpersonal risks, as Amy describes it.
Yeah.
And that's maybe a little bit more hidden. But what psychological safety has done, I guess, is brought that more kind of to the forefront, or that the conversations, at least, and the dialogue around it, at least getting people to talk about it. So safety is a broad term. But when we talk about psychological safety in the workplace, how would you describe that, Tom?
Yeah, so, and I think it's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because safety itself is about the absence, largely the absence of things going wrong.
Yeah.
And if we take a sort of safety two perspective, the things going right more often rather than things going wrong less often, depends which way we look at it. Certainly to my mind, and I could be completely wrong on this, but to my mind, psychological safety is the precursor to physical safety. Like one follows the other. You can't put physical safety in front of psychological safety. In order to have physical safety, you need to generate and foster psychological safety, because it's psychological safety, as we saw with Paul O'Neill at Alcoa, who reinvigorated the safety record and the business that was is Alcoa, the aluminium manufacturing company. In order to create that safety culture, the foundation of that is psychological safety.
Yeah, I agree.
And the ability to say, that looks unsafe, or I've got a concern about that thing or that process or that device or that tool or this patient. The ability to say, do you know what, I've got a better idea about how we might be able to do this, even if actually that idea is like that. You don't need to know that idea is a good idea. It might be a bad idea, but let's talk about the idea, because if we never take because of ideas, and this is what I one of the things I love about the sort of idea, the concept of psychological safety and ideas, is that we have all these ideas in our head, and they're safe in our heads, because while they're in our heads, no one can rip them apart or criticize them, but psychological safety allows us to take them out of our head and show it to someone.
Yeah that's really interesting. Yeah,
the danger is that someone then goes, no, that's rubbish, or just says, or, you know, don't ever suggest an idea to me again. For some reason, my old boss might have done that, but, you know, and that's where the everything else comes from. Not physical safety, as well as things like innovation and diversity and all the other sort of benefits of psychological safety. Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more. I often describe psychological safety as a cornerstone for, you know, innovation, improvement, creative problem solving, all that kind of, I suppose, textbook, if you want to call it textbook, kind of stuff. And so, you know, we've talked about fear. You know, fear very much gets in the way, doesn't it, of that kind of speaking up, etc. And so, I guess I want to take us down a rabbit, potentially down a rabbit hole. I'll try not to take us down the rabbit hole. But this whole idea of speaking up is something that I've been reflecting on a lot recently. And in one of your recent newsletters, I don't think it was the week before last. So I think it was like number 63. So there's a lot of them out there. People got some catching up to do if they haven't been reading them. They are epic. There's no other way to describe them. They are joyful when they land in your mailbox, I'm sure. But in that one, I was struck by the fact that you reflected, or you shared a very personal reflection of your own experience and your lack of confidence with voice. You know, I don't want to get, it's your story to tell, and hopefully you're happy to kind of share that story with our listeners a little bit. And I was interested that you then kind of linked it or anchored it to your, that maybe that's where some of your interest in psychological safety came from too. So I wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about that reflection with our listeners.
Yeah. So this is, it was actually that was quite a difficult newsletter to write, and I nearly deleted the whole thing because it was not only it was practically a therapy session. I was diagnosed with dyspraxia at a pretty young age, and that was, you know, that sort of diagnosis describes, I guess, sort of some degree of clumsiness and various other things. But in my case, it manifested in a degree of, well, not being able to speak very well. Yeah. And kind of in two ways. And I guess I've never really dived into exactly all of this, but like there were two ways in which I couldn't speak very well. One was the actual articulation of words and voice. Like I couldn't say certain sounds. I couldn't speak certain letters or words and things. So one of the last words I had real trouble with, apparently, was hammer. And now I can say hammer. So I'd love speech therapy for quite a long time. And I don't know if it's as a result of that or just associated with that. But I also struggled to, and I still struggle to some degree now, to articulate, to sort of form sentences in concise and articulate ways straight away. And when I start thinking about it, like I am right now, it gets even worse. But what that means is that sometimes I might take a while to get to the point, as I've just demonstrated. And that can be challenging for me and I guess other people maybe. But as a result of that childhood experience, so actually let me just skip forward. So then in my teenage years, I only really began to be able to speak properly when I was about seven or eight, nine maybe. And then when I was about 13, 14, I developed a stutter, like many teenage, particularly boys, do. And it's horrible, and most of us get over it. And I'm pretty much over it now. You know, I get the odd occasion when I stutter a bit, but what happened was that was awful, because that felt like, oh, like I've only had like 4 or 5 years of being able to talk properly, and now I'm back to this whole place where I can't even trust my own voice. I don't know if the thing I'm going to say is going to come even start to come out. A stutter is just an awful experience, because you feel like you've not got any control over your voice. You don't have control over your voice. I did then take I sort of worked out some strategies to speak better or more fluently, and that involved things like starting sentences with soft consonants, because it stutters really hard if you start a sentence with a duh or but or something like that. But if you start a sentence with an S or an F, you can, it lets you flow into the sentence what you're saying more. And once you're speaking, it's much easier. And so I sort of developed those sort of strategies. And so even now I use the word so an awful lot because it helps me flow into a sentence. The other thing I did was take singing lessons. There were like group singing classes at school, and they were a bit secret because it was a bit of a rough school. And if the other kids knew I was going to singing lessons, it wouldn't have worked out too well. But no one suffers when they sing.
Yes, that's right, Gareth Gates. I don't know if people will know him, but he was on, was it Pop Idol at the time, I think it was called, wasn't it? His story was very much around having this stutter, and he didn't do it when he was singing.
Yeah, and there are lots and lots of very famous singers that have a stutter, but obviously don't stutter when they sing. And so there's this different part of your brain that kicks in, and so the practice of singing appears to help people who have a stutter or stammer. And so I did that. But yeah, that whole experience kind of made the kind of really, I think, makes psychological safety and the ability, the internal belief, the strong, persistent internal belief that you can speak up, and you can speak, even not speak up, but speak without fear. And I think that is so visceral, so fundamentally part of my experience that when I sort of discovered this world of psychological safety, then it really spoke to me.
And I, you know, so firstly, I just want to thank you for feeling safe to share that reflection, because I actually, when I read it, I felt that strength in power of your experience in terms of actually, you know, that whole kind of fear and control and some of the other stuff we talk about, and you experienced it in a different way. So we talk about it in terms of and I want to move on to this in a second around power and how that silences, and you know, we'll chat a little bit more about that in a second. But I just felt that for those who maybe don't read your newsletter, and they should, if I haven't said that already. But, you know, those who don't get that opportunity, I think it was I am very grateful to you for sharing that experience, because I have to say that was one of the things that really stuck out for me in that particular newsletter. And that was the one thing that got me reflecting more around that whole kind of, you know, giving a voice to the voiceless. And because it's broad, it's much broader than it fits within the psychological safety, that umbrella term of psychological safety, of course it does. But it's broader, isn't it? That voice to the voiceless is about equality, it's about equity, it's about lots of different things. So thank you for sharing and thank you for being vulnerable, you know, because obviously it was a big deal for you. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And I genuinely did nearly delete the whole thing. I had my finger on the key ready to delete it. But I'm pleased I did send that out now.
Well, I, for one, am very glad that you didn't delete it. I got so much from your shared experience. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I think you've just touched on a really, really awesome point as well, which is that psychological safety, the ability to speak up, we have to be really careful to not just frame it in a kind of, and I think I mentioned this in the newsletter, but like in a neurotypical, westernized, standardized, business-like way.
Yeah.
Like we sometimes, in fact, I'm guilty of this. We describe what environment with psychological safety might look like, and it might involve people raising their hand and saying, "I have a concern," or speaking up and saying, "I've got an idea," or "I made a mistake." And that is true. That would probably be a psychologically safe space. But it also there are people. There may well be people in that space who are nonverbal. They might communicate via sign language. There are people in that space, there may be people in that space who wish to communicate primarily via written communications. There might be people who speak in a different language or a different dialect or other ways. Or they might have a tic, or they might have a stammer.
Yeah.
And so A more psychologically safe space would be a space that allows them to stammer and stutter and tick and or sign and whatever it is without any humiliation or embarrassment.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. So there's something here, isn't it, about how psychological safety needs to almost embody people's authenticity so that people feel that they can be their authentic self. Ticks, stammers, you know, preferences. Like, so for example, you know, one of the things that I get triggered by is when I'm called Rebecca, because I hate being called Rebecca. It always makes me feel like I'm in trouble. But it's interesting because I think one of the things that your reflection did for me was consider how even the minutiae, what might be minute to somebody in terms of so you've got a stammer, so what? Mm-hmm. But that has, well, how does that affect you and how you turn up, isn't it? And you know, we could absolutely talk about it. And I don't want to, and whilst we're still on the subject, I think of speaking up, because again, I think there's probably a series of podcasts here we could do around speaking up, come to think of it. It's a bit of a light bulb moment there. But yeah. But so Amy Edmondson in particular, and we refer to Amy because I think she's probably the most well-known person, aside from yourself, of course, Tom, around psychological, you know, around coining the term psychological safety. Yeah, and she's done a lot. She does a lot of championing and advocating for it. And she's amazing. You know, one of the most exciting moments for me over the last 12 months is when Amy started to follow me on Twitter. You know, I'm really, really am a big fan. She talks about this epidemic of silence. And one of my favorite quotes from her book, The Fearless Organization, is nobody wants to be the skunk at the picnic. The Kimball Scott, who wrote Radical Candor, and I refer to these two ladies because they actually work really well together, or their ideas work really well together. And so Kimball Scott talks about nobody wants to call their boss's baby ugly, you know, in terms of giving feedback. So there's another lady who has recently come on the scene for me in terms of some of this stuff. Her name is Megan Reitz. I hope I'm saying that well, but she talks very much about speaking up. I think she's a doctor by background. And it's interesting because you've talked about systems thinking. And actually, she says we need to stop trying to fix the silenced and rather fix the system. And so she goes on then to talk about enabling those who are in perceived positions of power to skillfully invite those who are silenced or who feel they don't have a voice to speak. But then also listening. So you can't speak without being heard, can you? So it's the two things cannot exist, independent of the other. And then she goes on to talk about actually sometimes leaders in healthcare, leaders in healthcare, we're turning our attention to creating these kind of speak up cultures. But there is research out there that tells us that we're not actually curing people because the power in the whether it be hierarchy, you know, in status hierarchy or whatever, is getting in the way. So I just wondered if you had a view on the relationship of power, speaking up, and that kind of like psychological safety.
Yeah, and I think so. This is super interesting. There's so much we could unpack. We must remember that it's the system that we need to address. Not necessarily fix, maybe fix, but we definitely need to address the system and not just sort of focus on the individual or individuals' actions. Like, individuals' actions matter. What we do and what we say absolutely matters. But we are part of the system. So by changing ourselves, we are changing the system. But if we don't take a systemic approach to what we're trying to do, then it will either fail or you know, we won't get very far. And I also think it's what's interesting is that over the past few decades, maybe through the entirety of the Industrial Revolution or, you know, whatever phase we're in of humanity right now, the way people have got into positions of power are power structures. And so what we're asking people to do when we're trying to fix this system is dismantle or change the power structures that got them there in the first place. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit like we're asking people who've climbed the ladder to, in their minds, sometimes like chopping out, destroying the ladder underneath them that's supporting them there. And that's what I think sometimes there's a fear of those in authority that some of these movements, some of these sort of paradigm shifts are risky to them. And we need to address that. Like we can't just sort of put leaders in this kind of, well, you've got to change, you've got to do things differently. They've got their own fears. And so we need to address that. The Psychological Safety Meetup last week had Dr. Kimberly Young McClear on, and she is absolutely incredible at addressing this sort of systemic change. Now, of course, very sorry, my cat has just come in the room and shouted
That's
at me.
That's okay. We live in a world now where the animals want as much attention as the humans.
he certainly feels safe to speak up.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Exactly. I've created a safe environment for my cats at least. I think we also have to be conscious. We have to be careful to not conflate power, structure and hierarchy. We can have very hierarchical organizations, we can have very structured organizations that are very psychologically safe and aren't necessarily, that may look hierarchical. In fact, they may well be. You know, there's maybe many, many layers between the person who's doing the thing on the ground and the person who's sort of in charge of the organization. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's not psychologically safe. There's a lot of military organizations, the US military for one, and I know the Marines and the Navy in the UK to use and talk about psychological safety a lot in their squadrons. Like it's almost a priori true that in order to succeed, to in order to perform as a tight knit squadron, you need to have psychological safety in that environment. And it doesn't. So even in a very hierarchical, very sort of structured organization, there is psychological safety. In fact, sometimes structure can foster psychological safety because you understand where you are, where you sit, what your expectations are, what your boundaries of decision making and authority and things are, and that understanding is really powerful to build psychological safety. Knowing where those lines are and what they mean. So we could dive into loads of interesting stuff about power, but power isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it should be. We should remember the whole power over versus power for thing, where we should be striving wherever possible to provide power for people, not power over people.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things I've written down here is agency. There's something here, isn't there, about giving people agency. So if, because, you know, and often power can be seen as a control tool or a tool that is used or, you know, or a thing then, maybe not a tool, but a thing that's used to control, like command and control or whatever. But often, you know, there may be some hidden agenda behind that leader around not wanting to relinquish control because of fear, because of previous experience, and because. So you're absolutely right. We need to better understand people's personal narrative around their experiences within organisations as well, I think, isn't there? There's something about this. Things you, okay, ask the question of self, but also ask the question of the organisation, isn't it? So is the organisation as such that it allows people to feel that they can relinquish some of that power and give agency to, you know, to the team or whatever to do things? Because as a leader or a manager in health, for example, if you relinquish that power and something goes wrong, ultimately, though, you as a leader or the manager, and again, there are differences between those terms, aren't there? But you're the ones that kind of cop it if things go, for want of a better word. And I agree with you. I think there is, you know, again, there's a whole podcast episode in discussing power, isn't there, I guess.
Yeah.
But I liked your example, actually, that you gave of the military, because the military are considered to be quite very kind of hierarchical with a tight structure, because they have to. But it's great that you highlighted the fact that they've still got that level of psychological safety. Now, if I think of a similar thing in healthcare, probably think of like those kind of like intensive areas, like intensive care. You haven't got time to mess around. You have to have that level of psychological safety, don't you, in order to function well as a team and to save people's lives, ultimately.
Yeah, you know.
So yeah, there's something here about context as well, I suppose, isn't there?
And particularly in those environments where you've got teams that are operating in fairly unpredictable environments or even chaotic environments, and this is as true in a busy hospital emergency room or a battlefield or running a live event. So one of my jobs was head of tech at a large concert venue with 10,000 people, stuff went down, and you need to make decisions quickly, and you need to have the psychological safety to be able to speak up to other people and say, I think we should do this, or just to say to someone, issue a command to someone and say, do that. I don't have time to explain why you need to do that. Mm. Just do that. Without having to go sort of up the chain, because if you go up the chain of command, by the time you get permission to do so, it's too late. And
that's where power can, we can get into all of that. Do you know what? I'm listening to you talking now, and so I'm a huge bookworm. I don't know if you've figured that out yet, but I am a huge bookworm, and I'm currently reading the book In the Heat of the Moment. I don't know if you've read it. I forget the name of the author, but she's a firefighter commander, and she talks about that kind of decision making and what happens when the decision making goes wrong. Is a fascinating read. It's really compelling. I'm almost as compelling as your newsletter. See what I'm doing there about your newsletter. But that's a great, and I mean, I guess now's not the time to necessarily delve into that, but those clinical decision making abilities and where power sits in that and everything else, I think it's hugely it absolutely fascinates me. But yeah, and I'm already feeling like we need a follow-up episode around psychological safety, around focusing on some of these key points. But yeah, so that's a great book, and I your little face lit up there when I talked about who it was.
I saw it. In fact, I think you shared it last week, but I've already put it on my list because
Tom.
Yeah,
you will love it, and it'd be great to have a chat with you about it, I guess, once you have read it. I'm about halfway through, and she's a great storyteller, which is, I think, a fundamental competence for a leader, is to be a great storyteller in order to engage the hearts and minds of the people that you want. You know, if you want people to follow you, you've got to be a great storyteller. So she's a great storyteller, and I won't labour on that point any longer because I'm not getting any, you know, financial reward for promoting the book, but it really is a great book. So so again, you know, I bring us back to your newsletter, and I am, you know, I'm getting sick of myself now keeping going on about your newsletter, but it is a great resource. And one of the things that you provide us with at the end of your newsletter is things to do and try. So I guess my final kind of question, talking point with you for our conversation today, Tom, was what advice or tips do you have for our leaders who are listening so that they can start to create psychological safety in the workplace? What would you give, like if you could give, say, three top tips or three top things to do, what would they be?
So one of these things just came to me while we were talking just then, because we know a lot of things people can do, but I think one of the most powerful things you can do as a leader, and this will partly foster psychological safety, but it will also improve performance. It will also improve your organization's and team's performance to get stuff done quickly and more effectively and make decisions and stuff like that. And that is, instead of trying to move information to where the authority to decide is, move the authority to where the information is. So try and I guess one way to look at that is to like look at sort of high performing teams who are on the front line, who are able to see something, make a decision and act without having to go outside the team or up the chain of command. It might be quite tricky as a leader to think about, well, where do those opportunities exist? Where do, you know, in order to, you know, my team, in order to make any decisions, need to check it with me first. Well, what sort of scale of decisions could you devolve authority for? What sort of size of risk are you willing for your team members to take without you saying okay or having to sign things off?
Mm.
And moving that authority down or forwards, depending, you know, I think is a really powerful way to improve performance and foster psychological safety. Mm. Through people they're trusted. They're trusted to make decisions. They're not even allowed to speak up, but encouraged to speak up with ideas and make decisions. So I think that's like the big one that we were just talking about. Another couple of things I always like to suggest to people is admit your mistakes. Admitting mistakes is super, quite basic, and it sounds so obvious, but super powerful way to foster psychological safety and encourage and enable people around you to admit their mistakes. And of course, we know that mistakes happen. Like when we punish mistakes, we're not reducing the number of mistakes, we're just reducing the number of mistakes we hear about.
Mm.
So those mistakes are going to happen. Things are going to go wrong. And when they do go wrong, we want to know about them so that we can, A, mitigate them, and B, try and prevent them happening again in the future. So admit your mistakes and you'll create an environment where other people can admit theirs. And lastly, this is neatly circling all the way back to the start of the podcast, is turning everything into an experiment and making everything experimental.
Because I love that.
I genuinely do try and run my life a bit like this, because if you treat everything as an experiment, no experiment ever fails. As long as you learn from the outcome of the experiment, no experiment ever fails. You learned that the thing you did didn't turn out the way you thought it would, or you learned that, yeah, well, that's, you know, or you learned it did. You learned actually, oh, that turned out better than I ever expected. But you'd never, the risk is that you would never have tried it in the first place if you didn't treat it as an experiment. And of course, what we do also really want to do is make sure we learn from things going not the way we expect.
Absolutely, yeah.
So treat everything as an experiment. The outcome of work shouldn't be the output, the productivity of work. The outcome of work should be learning how to do it better next time.
What a wonderful way to end. What a wonderful way to end our conversation, Tom. I love that. I mean, some great tips there. Thank you. And I love the way you circled it right the way back to the beginning of talking about being experimental. I think that's hugely important with that caveat around learning. So fail fast, mm-hmm. learn and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, Tom, I've had an absolute pleasure chatting with you, but I haven't quite finished with you yet. So we always ask our guests two kind of questions to finish off the episode. And the first of those is, do you have a leadership quote or a mantra or a philosophy that you try and embody on a day-to-day basis that helps you to be the best leader that you can be?
I was going to go back to the experimental one, but in treating it as an experiment. But I also genuinely believe that the best performance and the most success we generate in our lives is through, and the outcome is as well, happiness. If we create environments where we're trying to maximize happiness, genuine happiness that comes from achieving things and doing good stuff, not just comfort but happiness and joy, then not only are we going to create more high performance and have more good things happen, but, you know, if the only outcome is that we're all more happy and joyful, then well, that's a good enough outcome in itself, to be honest.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. There's who doesn't love a bit of joy in work? Exactly. I think that's a great philosophy to have, Tom. Thank you. And then last but not least, three dinner guests, dead or alive, real or fictional. Who are you going to invite?
This is so difficult, and I like, as I'm talking, I'm changing my mind. it's like I'm flicking through a roller deck that's constantly changing. But I'm just going to commit and say, one would be Anthony Bourdain. I'm a massive Anthony Bourdain fan, and I like, in so many ways, he's kind of one of my role models. And I think he'd be such an interesting person to speak to for a very long time.
Yeah.
Grace Hopper is another one of my role models, and I think again would be so, she was so intelligent and so ahead of her time in so many different ways. She co-invented COBOL. And she was an incredible leader. She got like 20 or so different degrees and
wow,
became U.S. Navy Rear Admiral, and just one of the most incredible women I've ever heard of. So Anthony Bourdain, Grace Hopper, and I also, do you know what, I'm really torn between William Edwards Deming, who would be...
I wondered if he was going to make an appearance, actually.
But I'm also torn between William Edwards Deming and Marsha P. Johnson, who was the black trans woman who basically kicked off the Stonewall riots.
Oh yes,
the very, very, like the catalyst for all for pride and everything we have now in terms of LGBTQ+ rights.
Yeah.
Marsha P. Johnson would be amazing to speak to.
Gosh, yeah, imagine the stories there. Some really great dinner guests there, and I'm going to give you the four, I think, because I can understand why you'd want William Deming there as well, given, you know, we've already mentioned him. He's already had a mention in the podcast.
Yeah.
So some great dinner guests there. So last year we ran a like a dinner guest league around Christmas time. So you better keep an eye out for that on Twitter, Tom, and get voting for your dinner guests. Try and get them into the final three if you can. So, I mean, that brings this episode to a close, although I could speak to you for hours, I have to say. And all that remains really is for me to thank you, Tom. Thank you for your honesty, your vulnerability in sharing your own reflections, and just being a real joy. I'm going to steal your word now. A real joy to chat to. I think I've really enjoyed our time together. And so thank you. And thank you to our guests for listening. So until next time, it's a goodbye from Tom.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Becky. It's been an absolute joy. I've really enjoyed that.
Great. And it's goodbye from us. Thanks for listening to The Leadership Log, where we're navigating everyday leadership. This is a non-affiliated podcast, and any views, thoughts and opinions expressed by the hosts or guests belong solely to them, and not necessarily to their employer, organisation, committee or other group or individual.